You're listening to a presentation given by journalist Morris Stevens on March 19th. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva. WXXE Fenner Syracuse 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville. We return to the conclusion of Maura Stevens' presentation.
So many bad things have happened because of the foolhardy, arrogant, short-sighted policies of the United States and its allies. We were warned about almost everything that has come to pass by scores of area experts beforehand. But the neoconservatives who orchestrated this mess paid no attention, just as they pay no attention to the civilians who suffered during and after the invasion. Just as they terrorized the people of the United States into thinking that Iraq had some connection to the September 11th terrorist attacks. Just as they and their predecessors in the Clinton administration paid no attention to what is really a genocide. 2 million deaths as a direct result of U.S. policies is, forgive me for using the term, nothing less than a genocide. There are no easy answers now. We have made this mess, and we are responsible for cleaning it up. I believe we owe it to the people of Iraq to try to make things easier for them as they set about the long road to rebuilding their shattered country and their shattered lives. The Iraqi people have been through too much. They really need relief. The only way they have even kept going, we're sure, is that they have such a strong society, such deep ties to each other, to community, to family, and to country. We can see even that shattering if it comes to what this administration wanted in the first place, which was the rebuilding of Iraq in the capitalist Western image, if it could ever happen now that the United States and other commercial interests can set up shop there, marketing Nike and McDonald's and who knows what else they don't want or need. But that scenario is looking less likely by the day. Anti-Semitism is growing at an alarming rate. It is already bad. Everything that happens everywhere in the Middle East is tied to Palestine, which doesn't appear on most maps, and the treatment of Palestinians by Israel and the United States. Iraqis, like many people in the Muslim world, believe the invasion of Iraq and the oppression of Palestinians are signs that the United States wants to subjugate all of the Arab Muslim world. Whether or not this is true, the belief feeds the fundamentalist extremists like Osama bin Laden and gives rise to thousands of groups like Al-Qaeda. It puts U.S. soldiers in more dire danger every day as well. The numbers of U.S. military casualties are going up alarmingly and show signs of getting even worse. There are now more than 70 attacks a day on U.S. and coalition forces in nearly every major city. The Iraqi Prime Minister Ayad Alawi, in a September speech to Congress, described Baghdad as very good and safe. Obviously, he thinks we're very stupid. Do you know that not a single member of the administration, not one single member of this administration, and only one member of Congress, Senator Tim Johnson of South Dakota, has a child serving on active duty in Iraq? I don't see how any parent or spouse or sibling or child or sweetheart of a soldier can tolerate our government's blatant disregard for the safety of their loved ones. It's simply inevitable that U.S. and other Western civilians will be targeted in backlash as well, both abroad and at home. I don't think any U.S. citizen should forgive our administration for bringing us to this point. Iraq is not safer, and we're not safer. We are much, much less safe than we were on March 18th, 2003, 2 years and 1 day ago. Zayed al-Ali, an Iraqi attorney who has practiced in New York and Paris, returned to his native land and wrote this past fall about what he saw. Nothing irritates Iraqis more. Nothing has served to prove to them that the occupation is not designed to serve their interests or improve their living standards than the constant failures in the electricity supply, the incessant problems relating to corruption, and the failure to establish security and law. Iraqis cannot accept that the continuing problems are unavoidable, and from that starting point inevitably reached the conclusion that the Bush administration is secretly plotting to keep them in a position of poverty and insecurity. A Wall Street Journal recently reporter recently wrote from Baghdad, despite President Bush's rosy assessments, Iraq remains a disaster. If under Saddam it was a potential threat, then under the Americans it has been transformed to imminent and active threat, a foreign policy failure bound to haunt the United States for decades. There are car bombs going off every day around the country, killing and injuring scores of innocent people. The roads are becoming impassable and littered by hundreds of landmines and explosive devices aimed to kill American soldiers. There are assassinations, kidnappings, and beheadings. It's a raging, barbaric guerrilla war. Who did this war benefit? Was it worth it? Are we safer because Saddam is holed up and Al-Qaeda is running around in Iraq? Iraqis say that thanks to America, they got freedom in exchange for insecurity. Guess what? They say they take security over freedom any day, even if it means having a dictator ruler. I heard an educated Iraqi say today that if Saddam Hussein were allowed to run for elections, he would get the majority of the vote. Contrary to what some people think, the administration had a plan for Iraq all along, but it was a bad plan, and it has backfired horribly. Yet we hear no voice in this administration apologizing, nor a soul among them admitting to having made a mistake. Instead, George W. Bush says he would not change a thing, and he can't think of a single error he has made. As long as people in this country continue to believe that kind of nonsense, the nonsense they've been fed, continue to believe that Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction are hidden in the desert somewhere, that Saddam had something to do with Al-Qaeda and the attacks of 9/11 on the United States, and that invading Iraq has made Americans safer, this administration will continue to perpetrate these lies. As long as people in this country continue to believe that it couldn't happen here in the United States, that we are better off because we deserve to be, that geography has nothing to do with one's lot in life, as long as Americans convince themselves that this war had nothing to do with oil and hegemony, as long as Americans can complacently tell themselves that Iraqis are all insurgents who don't want freedom and democracy, who don't care if their children haven't got clean water, and they don't really need electricity or a way to cook their meager foodstuffs, that they don't deserve decent schools and health care, things will not change. Because only through the apathy and ignorance of the people could such lies be allowed to stand and such desperate humanitarian conditions be tolerated. Americans have got to stop being complacent. I realize I'm speaking to the choir here, but I'm hoping that each of you can try and find someone who's not in the choir and convince them that this is an important issue. I also encourage you to visit the website of the Project for a New American Century if you haven't already, and read the few paragraphs of its statement of principles. This is also known as the Wolfowitz Doctrine or the Bush Doctrine, although George W. Bush had nothing to do with it. Wolfowitz did. You can see in these few paragraphs what a small group of neoconservative millionaires, including Cheney, Rumsfeld, Jeb Bush, Paul Wolfowitz, Bill Kristol, Steve Forbes, Scooter Libby, and Richard Perle have been planning for almost 8 years. You can see that our long-fought-for doctrine of non-proliferation of nuclear weaponry has been tossed aside for the greater interests of global domination in the plans of these men. Maybe this is the kind of United States of America you want, or somebody wants. I know it's not the kind of USA I want. But at least it should be discussed and debated, not foisted upon the country like the USA Patriot Act was. By the way, there's another USA Patriot Act in front of Congress right now. Note that the United States has a military presence in more than 1,000 places around the world. U.S. troops have been deployed recently in the Philippines, Yemen, Georgia, Colombia, and in Indonesia, creating new possibilities for expanded war. In late 2002, the Clinton administration said that Russia, China, Iraq, Iran, Syria, North Korea, and Libya are considered by the U.S. as possible targets for nuclear attack. Well, that kind of rhetoric, not to mention that kind of attitude, fosters conflicts everywhere. Seymour Hersh, the remarkable investigative reporter who, incidentally, will be at Ithaca College this Thursday at 7:30 p.m. in Ford Hall. It's free and open to the public. I encourage you to get there early if you want to see it. He came out in January with a report in the New Yorker that says George W. Bush has already set into motion events that may make aggressive action in Iran inevitable. I'm sure you've heard that by now. Attacking Iran militarily while Iraq and Afghanistan are still in chaos is radically dangerous, not only for the region, but for the United States and indeed the entire world. Yet George W. Bush said to the Washington Post recently that nobody in his administration has done anything wrong in regards to Iraq. He believes that he has a mandate. He says, we had an accountability moment, and that's called the 2004 election. The American people listened to different assessments made about what was taking place in Iraq, and they looked at the two candidates and chose me, for which I am grateful. Mr. Bush really believes he has a mandate to continue his failed policies in Iraq, and he believes that he has a military mandate as well. I don't think this is what the American electorate meant on November 2nd. I believe that perhaps a lot of Americans were afraid of changing horses in midstream or whatever, but they also want our troops out of Iraq before things get even worse. And they certainly don't want to start a new invasion. I certainly hope that I'm believing the right thing about the American people. I promised I'd give you some reasons for optimism, some recommendations. As I said, nothing from now on will be easy in Iraq. Sectarian division has grown over the last 2 years. George and I actually saw and heard no sign of sectarian division while we were there, either before the invasion under Saddam or afterward during the occupation. In fact, we met dozens of people in mixed families, Kurds married to Shia, Shia married to Sunni, etc. Before the invasion, people seemed to pull together as Iraqis. The schisms that have exploded since the occupation seem to have been fueled largely by outside, something from outside. Apparently, creating a democracy means to some advisors that there must be widely divergent parties, so there's perennial conflict, making for more interesting politics. Now the Iraqi parliament has got to try to pull together. They're charged with creating a constitution, and then they have to put it before a referendum, which is going to be another potentially dangerous election that is supposed to happen before October 15th. And then they have elections in December to choose a new permanent government. Whatever happens, you can be sure that the U.S. public will be told again and again that the Iraqi people have expressed their democratic wishes and that the U.S. has really brought freedom to Iraq. I do have a few recommendations. One, do everything you can to get the House to vote against President Bush's $80 billion supplemental spending bill for Iraq, $81.4 billion actually. The Senate approved this bill on Wednesday, but it still has to go through the House. Congress is in recess for the next 3 weeks, so most representatives are in their home offices, which is a great time to reach them. I believe, although I haven't confirmed, that both New York Senators Hillary Rodham Clinton and Chuck Schumer voted against it. And if you're in Representative Maurice Hinchey's district, you can count on him to vote against it. But even so, let these Congress members know you're behind them. The bill still must pass the House. And so even if your representative has already voted against military funding in Iraq in the past, it's essential that you contact them again. And certainly, Maurice Hinchey could use the backing. I mean, it's nice to let your Congress members know something, that you're behind them, too, even if you're not urging them to change their mind. And please help your friends and family members in other districts and states write letters to their representatives. We have to maintain public pressure on all elected officials if we're ever going to end this occupation. The bill is for $81.4 billion. $75 billion of that will be allocated to fund military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, mostly Iraq. $1.5 billion of $81.4 billion will be used to construct a new U.S. embassy complex in Baghdad. This will drive the U.S. deficit up to $427 billion, according to the White House. Total 2005 funding for U.S. military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan is $105 billion, more than 2.5 times the budget for the Department of Homeland Security, and 13 times larger than the budget for the entire Environmental Protection Agency. Number two, Bush has got to replace Donald Rumsfeld, Defense Secretary. Now, in the last 2 weeks, we've had some interesting news. Undersecretaries of Defense Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Faith are already on the way out. Faith has just resigned quietly. And Wolfowitz seems to be heading to the World Bank, which isn't such a good thing necessarily. But who knows, maybe it's a sign that the administration wants to focus on eradicating hunger and poverty instead of waging war. Cynical voices. That would be a good sign, though, wouldn't it? But the men who orchestrated this mess really must be made accountable. And until they are, nobody in Iraq is going to believe a word coming out of this administration. I somehow doubt Rumsfeld will be canned by the president, but we can hope. Do remember interim elections, too. We're only 20 months from less than 20 months from interim elections. We can always make changes there, move to other states and vote there. The United States and the United States must also work seriously with new Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to build a lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians and to create a Palestinian state. Mr. Bush has already paid lip service to doing this, but now he has to show that the U.S. means business or the Muslim world will never work with the United States toward peaceful solutions to problems in Iraq or anywhere in the Middle East. And anti-Semitism will continue to grow, making Israel more and more vulnerable. This is too great a price to pay. American Jews especially need to get active on this issue because they stand to lose so much. And people of other faiths who care about interfaith relations and peace and justice should jump on board to build a coalition of resistance to the occupation, reconciliation, peace-building, and nation-building for both Palestinians and Israelis. There are many good groups already working on this issue, and lest I forget to mention this later, there's a resource list over there, and there's also an action list, so please, everybody, take a copy of that. I may not have enough, but I can email them to you if you like. The next thing is that Bush must empower Congress to form a bipartisan committee on the U.S. role in rebuilding Iraq. Iraq, led by moderates from both parties with expertise in both military and humanitarian affairs. And this committee must work closely with the United Nations. And the United States must work within United Nations frameworks without bullying other nations into submissions. Don't hold your breath, but stranger things have happened. Five, the United States absolutely must step down from its leadership role in the occupation and reconstruction of Iraq. It must cede this responsibility to Iraq's relatively friendly neighboring countries. Only Arab countries, Muslim countries, have a chance of winning the trust of Iraqis at this point. It is way too late for the United States. All the PR in the world will make up for 15 years of what Iraqis now see as punishment. 20 months ago, even 16 months ago, we had a chance of proving that we were sincere in our desire to help Iraqis. Now those promises we made are perceived as completely insincere. Neighboring countries that could provide leadership, possibly, although they're very far from perfect themselves, are Jordan, Lebanon, now a little bit engaged in other things, but still interested, United Arab Emirates, and Yemen. The next thing, six, United States must put its reconstruction money into Iraqi companies, hiring Iraqi workers to rebuild schools, homes, and infrastructure. The big multinationals have to be sent home immediately. There is no hope for weakening the insurgency while Iraqi men are unemployed and their families haven't got clean water, food, access to medicine and education, or visas out of the country. I really urge you to write your representatives as well as the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations members and tell them that it is past time that Iraqi companies and workers get the job of rebuilding their country, that's information on the resource list, that U.S. and multinational corporations should not be reaping the benefits from the destruction of Iraq. 7. The United States must craft a policy for full withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq by the middle of 2006 and stick to it. The Pentagon must also create a program whereby its soldiers are not kept on active duty in Iraq indefinitely. The military must strengthen, not weaken, veterans' benefits, and Congress must fully fund programs for both physical and mental health care for returning soldiers. Those recommendations are only a start. The only chance that any of these policies will be implemented is if we pressure our legislators to pressure the White House. We have to work through the Veterans Administration, through other veterans groups, through the media. We have to support independent media. We have to lobby with our wallets. We have to stop patronizing corporations as customers and as investors that follow practices against our beliefs, and we have to support those whose ethics are sound. We have to be there for our returned soldiers to help them through and let them know we honor them as people, but not the war they have been through. We have to encourage conscientious objectors to act with their hearts. Some of you might feel compelled to be war tax resistors. We have to be there for those who are left behind by the soldiers who are not coming home. We have to be there to help the Iraqi people whose only fault was being born in the wrong place at the wrong time. So we have a lot of work to do. I'm sure that many of you know what Adolf Hitler wrote in his 1925 book, Mein Kampf, but it's good to remind ourselves often. He wrote, The broad mass of the nation will more easily fall victim to a big lie than to a small one. His Nazi propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, said, if you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. Well, we have been lied to with numerous huge whoppers over and over again, and people do seem to believe them. Goebbels was right on that count. Another ghastly person of the 20th century, Nazi Reich Marshal Hermann Göring, before committing suicide, said at the Nuremberg trials, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they're being attacked and denounce the peacemakers for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country. I'm planning to go to Amman, Jordan on April 21st and spend about 2 weeks there and at the Iraqi border with Jordan. I'm meeting up with some Iraqi friends there. They'll help me get access to Iraqis in exile, many of whom are illegally in Jordan and sort of in the underground economy right now. I'll be making these connections and gathering as many firsthand stories as I can, taping my interviews with Iraqis and writing stories for various publications and hopefully reporting for Free Speech Radio. I hope to bring the stories back and share them with the Ithaca community and with Americans around the country. I'm currently raising money for that trip. I need to raise at least $6,000 more from private donations. If I don't reach the goal, I'll send the money that I do raise instead with my Iraqi-American friend Amira, who will get it directly to the people we know through her brother, Haider. I don't like to ask for help, and especially not for money. Ithacans and others were very generous with donations before our last two trips. We couldn't have done it without that generosity. People gave money, and especially healthcare items, medicines, gifts for children and women, and personal cards and letters. This time I'm not carrying in anything except cash and personal cards and letters. With the terrible economy there and lack of jobs and security, cash is desperately needed. Every single day I get a plea from one of our contacts there asking if there's any way we can get money in. The only way we've been able to do that so far is by sending money in through several soldiers who are working with Iraqi translators we know, and then they manage to distribute the money. It's gotten in safely, and it's been it's gotten to the people that we wanted it to get to. But at this point, George and I have been through all our savings, and most of our current income has been on activism, research, and educating people, and trying to support people in need, both here and at home and in Iraq, and we're kind of tapped out. So I feel compelled to continue this work because I do see a little progress being made, and because of it, I hope, however slow it seems, it does seem that a little bit of good is being done by the work that I'm doing. So I ask for your help in this effort. I'm asking on behalf of the Iraqi people so that we can help get their stories out to people in the United States and we hope improve their lives. So thank you in advance for any help you can give us. We'd like to leave you with some images of the beautiful people of Iraq with whom we fell in love. These pictures are actually from times that were better in many ways because at least at that time they had food and housing and jobs and electricity and water. Things they've now gone without for 24 months. Worrying about these people has kept us awake nights for the last 2 years. We know that actually some of them have died since George took these pictures just 5 weeks before the invasion. But we ask that you please keep them in your thoughts and hearts, and don't forget who suffers when arrogance and ignorance rule the day. Please don't forget them. Because they really are us, and we are they. It could be the other way around, and it might well be yet. What has happened to them could happen anywhere, even closer to home, if we're not vigilant and if we do not actively take a stand to protect one another. After all, we're all in this together. Thank you.
You've been listening to Maura Stevens, a longtime journalist and activist, speaking on March 19th. In Ithaca, New York. Some events coming up next week for listeners in the Finger Lakes. Tomorrow, Monday, March 28th, the next Back to Democracy meeting will be held at 7 p.m. at the Rongovian Embassy on Main Street in Teberg. Megan Sheehan and Risa Sokolsky will be presenting information on fair trade versus free trade and also on the Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA, which Congress will be voting on in the next few months. The presentation will be followed by a discussion. The event is free and all are welcome. On Thursday, March 31st, in Seneca Falls, there will be a free screening of End of Suburbia, a documentary dealing with the coming petroleum shortages. It will screen at 6:30 p.m. at the Seneca Falls Community Center at 35 Water Street, by the canal in Seneca Falls Village. And on this program next week, Seymour Hersh will speak on Chain of Command. If you missed his amazing public lecture last week, this is for you, so tune in next week for Seymour Hersh. We'll conclude the program with a final version of Scooter's radio adaptation of Mark Twain's satirical, posthumously published work, The Mysterious Stranger, about the adventures of the archangel Satan when he gets involved with the lives of the people of a medieval Austrian village. After befriending three boys he meets on the road, he tries to help their friend, Father Peter, an impoverished priest who's been suspended for advocating the universal compassion of God. Satan slips a pile of gold ducats in Father Peter's lost wallet. But then, just as he thinks he saved his home from being repossessed by the moneylender, Father Peter is falsely accused by his enemy, the astrologer, of stealing the money from him, and the priest is taken to prison. Satan then provides Father Peter's admirable niece, Margot, and their pious housekeeper, Ursula, with a magic cat that provides endless food and a small supply of coin each week. When they share their bounty with the villagers, they are suspected of witchcraft, for which villagers are burned at the stake on a regular basis. Can't you hear my lambs calling? Oh, good shepherd, feed my sheep.
Days and days went by now, and no Satan. It was dull without him. But the astrologer, who had returned from his excursion to the moon, went about the village braving public opinion and getting a stone in the middle of his back now and then when some witch hunter got a safe chance to throw it and dodge out of sight. Margaret asked Wilhelm Meidling to defend her uncle in the approaching trial, and he was greatly pleased and began his preparation with diligence, with more diligence than hope, in fact, for it was not a promising case. He had many interviews in his office with Seppi and I, and threshed out our testimony pretty thoroughly, thinking to find some valuable grains among the chaff, but the harvest was poor. If only Satan would come, that was my constant thought. He could invent some way to win this case, for he had said it would be won, so he necessarily knew how it could be done. But the days dragged on, and still he didn't come. Of course, I did not doubt that it would be won, and that Father Peter would be happy for the rest of his life, since Satan had said so. Yet, I knew I should be more comfortable if he would come and tell us how to manage it. It was high time for Father Peter to have a saving change toward happiness, for by general report, he was worn out with his imprisonment and the humiliation that was burdening him, and was like to die of his miseries unless he got relief soon. At last, the trial came, and the people gathered from all around to witness it. Among them, many strangers from considerable distances. Yes, everybody was there except the accused. He was too feeble in body for the strain. But Margaret was present, and keeping up her hope and her spirit the best she could. The money was present, too. It was emptied on the table, and was handled and caressed and examined by such as were privileged. The accuser, the astrologer, was put in the witness box. He had on his best hat and robe for the occasion. Question: you claim this money is yours? I do. How did you come by it? I found the bag on the road when I was returning from a journey. When? More than 2 years ago. What did you do with it? I brought it home and hid it in a secret place in my observatory, intending to find the owner, if I could. You endeavored to find him? I made diligent inquiries during several months, but nothing came of it. And then? I thought it not worthwhile to look further, and was minded to use the money in finishing the wings of the foundling asylum, connected with the priory and the nunnery. So I took it out of its hiding place and counted it to see if any of it was missing. And then, why do you stop? The astrologer went on. I'm sorry to have to say this, but just as I had finished and was restoring the bag to its place, I looked up, and there stood Father Peter behind me. The prosecutor asked, that made you uneasy? No, I thought nothing of it at the time, for Father Peter often came to me unannounced to ask for a little help in his need. Margaret blushed crimson at hearing her uncle falsely and impudently charged with begging, especially from one he had always denounced as a fraud. The astrologer went on, in the end, I was afraid to contribute the money to the foundling asylum, but elected to wait yet another year and continue my inquiries. When I heard of Father Peter's find, I was glad, and no suspicion entered my mind. When I came home a day or two later and discovered that my own money was gone, I still did not suspect until three circumstances connected with Father Peter's good fortune struck me as being singular coincidences. Pray name them. Father Peter had found his money in a path. I had found mine in a road. Father Peter's find consisted exclusively of gold ducats, mine also. Father Peter found 1,107 ducats, I exactly the same. This closed his evidence, and certainly had made a strong impression on the house. One could see that. Wilhelm Meidling asked him some questions, then called us boys, and we told our tale. It made the people laugh, and we were ashamed. We were feeling pretty badly anyhow, because Wilhelm was hopeless in showing it. He was doing as well as he could, poor young fellow, but nothing was in his favor. It might be difficult for the court and the people to believe the astrologer's story, considering his character, but it was almost impossible to believe Father Peter's. We were already feeling badly enough, but when the astrologer's lawyer said he believed he would not ask us any questions, for our story was a little delicate, and it would be cruel of him to put any strain upon it, everybody laughed, and it was almost more than we could bear. Then he made a sarcastic little speech and got so much fun out of our tale, and it seemed so ridiculous and childish in every way impossible and foolish that it made everybody laugh until the tears came. And at last, Margaret could not keep her courage any longer, but broke down and cried. I was sorry for her. Now I noticed something that braced me up. It was Satan standing alongside of Wilhelm, and there was such a contrast. Satan looked so confident, had such a spirit in his eyes and face, and Wilhelm looked so depressed and despondent. We were comfortable now, and judged that he would testify and persuade the bench and the people that black was white, and white black, or any other color he wanted it. We glanced around to see what the strangers in the house thought of him, for he was beautiful, you know, stunning, in fact, but no one was noticing him, so we knew, by that, he was invisible. The lawyer was saying his last words, and while he was saying them, Satan began to melt into Wilhelm. He melted into him and disappeared, and then there was a change, when his spirit began to look out of Wilhelm's eyes. The other lawyer finished quite seriously and with dignity. He pointed to the money and said, "The love of it is the root of all evil. There it lies, the ancient tempter, newly red with the shame of its latest victory, the dishonor of a priest of God, and his two poor juvenile helpers in crime. If it could speak, let us hope that it would be constrained to confess that of all its conquest, this was the basest and most pathetic." He sat down. Wilhelm rose and said, "From the testimony of the accuser, I gather that he found this money in a road more than 2 years ago. Correct me, sir, if I am wrong." The astrologer said his understanding was correct. Wilhelm turned toward the bench and said, "If I prove that this money here was not that money, then it is not his." The judge replied, "Certainly not, but this is irregular. If you had such a witness, it was your duty to give proper notice of it and have him here too." He broke off and began to consult with the other judges. Meantime, the other lawyer got up excited and began to protest against allowing new witnesses to be brought into the case at this late stage. The judges decided his contention was just and must be allowed. "But this is not a new witness," said Wilhelm. "And it has already been partly examined. I speak of the coins." "The coin? What can the coin say?" "It can say that it is not the coin that the astrologer once possessed. It can say it was not in existence last December. By its date, it can say this." And it was so. There was the greatest excitement in the court, while the lawyer and the judges were reaching for the coins and examining them and exclaiming. And everybody was full of admiration of Wilhelm's brightness in happening to think of this neat idea. At last order was called, and the court said, "All the coins but four are of the date of the present year. The court tenders its sincere sympathy to the accused and its deep regret that he, an innocent man, through an unfortunate mistake, has suffered the undeserved humiliation of imprisonment and trial. The case is dismissed." So the money could speak, after all. The court rose, and almost everyone came forward to shake hands with Margaret and congratulate her, and then to shake with Wilhelm and praise him, and Satan had stepped out of Wilhelm and was standing around looking on full of interest, and people walking through him every which way, not knowing he was there. And Wilhelm could not explain why he only thought of the date on the coins at the last moment instead of earlier. He said it just occurred to him, all of a sudden, like an inspiration, and he brought it right out without hesitation. For although he didn't examine the coins, he seemed, somehow, to know it was true. He had dulled down a little now. Not much, but still you could notice that he hadn't that luminous look in his eyes that he had while Satan was in him. He nearly got it back now, for a moment, when Margaret came and praised him and thanked him, and couldn't keep him from seeing how proud she was of him. The astrologer went off dissatisfied and cursing, and Solomon Isaacs gathered up the money and carried it away. It was Father Peter's for good now. Satan was gone. I judged he had spirited himself away to the jail to tell the prisoner of the news, and in this I was right. Well, what Satan had done was this. He had gone to Father Peter, exclaiming, "The trial is over, and you stand forever disgraced as a thief, by verdict of the court." The shock unseated the old man's reason. When we arrived 10 minutes later, he was parading around, pompously up and down and delivering commands to this and that and the other constable or jailer and calling them Grand Chamberlain and Prince this and that, and Admiral of the Fleet, Field Marshal in command, and all such nonsense, and was happy as a bird. He thought he was the Emperor. Margaret flung herself on his breast and cried, and indeed everybody was moved almost to heartbreak. He recognized Margaret, but could not understand why she should cry. He patted her on her shoulder and said, "Don't do it, dear. Remember, there are witnesses, and this is not becoming of the Crown Princess. Tell me your trouble. It shall be mended, and there is nothing the Emperor cannot do." Then he looked around and saw old Ursula with her apron over her eyes. He was puzzled at that and said, "And what's the matter with you?" Through her sob she got out words explaining that she was distressed to see him so. He reflected over that a moment, then muttered, as if to himself, "A singular old thing. The Dowager Duchess means well, but it is always snuffling and never able to tell what it is about. It is because she doesn't know." His eyes fell on Wilhelm. "Prince of India," he said, "I divine that it is you that the Crown Princess is concerned about. Her tears shall be dried. I will no longer stand between you. She shall share your throne, and between you, you shall inherit mine. There, little lady, have I done well? You can smile now, isn't it so? He patted Margaret and kissed her, and was so contented with himself and with everybody that he could not do enough for us all, but began to give away kingdoms and such things right and left, and the least any of us got was a principality. And so at last, being persuaded to go home, he marched in imposing state, and when the crowds along the way saw how it gratified him to be hurrahed, they humored him at the top of his desire, and he responded with condescending bows and gracious smiles, and often stretched out a hand and said, "Bless you, my people." As pitiful a sight as I ever saw. On my road home, I came upon Satan and reproached him with deceiving me like that. He was not embarrassed, but said quite simply and composedly, "You mistake. It was the truth. I said he would be happy the rest of his days, and he will, for he will always think that he is the emperor, and his pride in it and his joy in it will endure to the end of his days. He is now and will remain one utterly happy person in his empire." "But the method of it, Satan, the method. Couldn't you have done it without depriving him of his reason?" It was difficult to irritate Satan, but that accomplished it. "What an ass you are," he said. "Are you so unobservant as not to have found that sanity and happiness are an impossible combination? No sane man can be happy, for to him life is real, and he sees what a fearful thing it is. Only the mad can be truly happy, and not many of those. The few that imagine themselves kings or gods are happy. The rest are no happier than the sane. Of course, no man is entirely in his right mind at any time, but I've been referring to the extreme cases. I have taken from this man that trumpery thing which this race regards as mind. I have replaced his tin life with a silver gilt fiction. You see the result. And you criticize? I said I would make him permanently happy, and I have done it. I have made him happy by the only means possible to this race, and you're not satisfied." He heaved a discouraged sigh and said, "It seems to me this race is hard to please." "There it is, you see. He didn't seem to know any way to do a person a favor, except by killing him or making a lunatic of him. I apologized as well I could, but privately, I did not think much of his processes." Satan was accustomed to say that our race lived a life of continuous and uninterrupted self-deception. It duped itself from cradle to grave with shams and delusions, which it mistook for realities, and this made its entire life a sham. Of the score of fine qualities which it imagined it had, it really possessed hardly one. It regarded itself as gold and was only brass. One day, when he was in this vein, he mentioned a detail, the sense of humor. I cheered up then and took issue. I said, "We possess that." "There speaketh the race," he said, "always ready to claim what it hasn't got and mistake its ounce of brass filings for a ton of gold dust. You have a mongrel perception of humor, nothing more. A multitude of you possess that. This multitude see the comic side of a thousand low-grade and trivial things, broad incongruities, mainly grotesqueries, absurdities, evokers of the horse laugh. The 10,000 high-grade comicalities which exist in the world are sealed from their dull vision. Will a day come when the race will detect the funniness of these juvenilities and laugh at them, and by laughing at them destroy them? For your race, in its poverty, has unquestionably one really effective weapon, laughter. Power, money, persuasion, supplication, persecution, these can lift a colossal humbug, push it a little, weaken it a little, century by century, but only laughter can blow it to rags and atoms at a blast. Against the assault of laughter, nothing can stand. You are always fussing and fighting with your other weapons. Do you ever use that one? No, you leave it lying rusting. Do you ever use it at all? No, you lack the sense and the courage." We were traveling at the time and stopped at a little city in India and looked on while a juggler did his tricks before a group of villagers. They were wonderful, but I knew Satan could beat that game, and I begged him to show off a little, and he said he would. He changed himself into a native in turban and breechcloth, and very considerately conferred on me temporary knowledge of the language. The juggler exhibited a seed, covered it with earth in a small flower pot, then put a rag over the pot. After a minute, the rag began to rise. In 10 minutes, it had risen a foot. Then the rag was removed, and the little tree was exposed, with leaves upon it and ripe fruit. We ate the fruit and it was good, but Satan said, "Why do you cover the pot? Can't you grow the tree in the sunlight?" "No," said the juggler, "no one can do that." "You're only an apprentice. You don't know your trade. Give me this seed. I'll show you." And he took the seed and he said, "What shall I raise from it?" "It's a cherry seed, of course. It will raise a cherry." "Oh, no, that's a trifle. Any novice could do that. Shall I raise an orange tree from it?" "Oh, yes," said the juggler and laughed. "And shall I make it bear other fruits as well as oranges?" "If God wills," and they all laughed. Satan put the seed in the ground, put a handful of dust on it, and said, "Rise." A tiny stem shot up and began to grow, and grew so fast that in 5 minutes it was a great tree, and we were sitting in the shade of it. There was a murmur of wonder. Then all looked up and saw a strange and pretty sight, for the branches were heavily laden with fruits of many kinds and colors, oranges, grapes, bananas, peaches, cherries, apricots, and so on. Baskets were brought, and the unloading of the tree began, and the people crowded around Satan and kissed his hand and praised him, calling him the Prince of Jugglers. The news went about the town, and everybody came running to see the wonder, and they remembered to bring baskets, too. But the tree was equal to the occasion. It put out new fruits as fast as they were removed. Baskets were filled by the score and by the hundred, but always the supply remained undiminished. At last, a foreigner, in white linen and sun helmet, arrived, and exclaimed angrily, "Away from here! Clear out, you dogs! This tree is on my lands, and this is my property." The natives put down their baskets and made humble obeisance. Satan made humble obeisance, too, with his fingers to his forehead, in the native way, and said, "Please, let them have their pleasure for an hour, sir. Only that, and no longer. Afterward you may forbid them, and you will still have more fruit than you and the state together can consume in a year." This made the foreigner very angry, and he cried out, "Who are you, you vagabond, to tell your betters what they may or may not do?" And he struck Satan with his cane and followed this error with a kick. The fruits rotted on the branches and the leaves withered and fell. The foreigner gazed at the bare limbs with the look of one who was surprised and not gratified. Satan said, "Take good care of this tree, for its health and yours are bound together. It will never bear again, and if you tend it well, it will live long. Water its roots once an hour every night, and do it yourself. It must not be done by proxy, and to do it in daylight will not answer. If you fail only once in any night, the tree will die, and you likewise. Do not go home to your own country anymore. You would not reach there. Do not rent or sell this place. It would be injudicious." The foreigner was very proud and wouldn't beg, but I thought he looked as if he would like to. While he stood gazing at Satan, we vanished away and landed in Ceylon. I was sorry for the man. Sorry Satan hadn't been his customary self and killed him or made him a lunatic. It would have been a mercy. Satan overheard the thought and said, "I would have done that but for his wife, who has not offended me. She's coming to him presently from their native land, Portugal. She is well, but has not long to live, and has been yearning to see him and persuade him to go back with her next year. She will die without knowing he can't leave that place." "He won't tell her?" He will not trust that secret with anyone. He will fear that it could be revealed in his sleep, in the hearing of some servant at one time or another." "Did none of those natives understand what you said to him?" "None. None of them understood. But he will always be afraid that some did. That fear will torture him, for he has been a harsh master to them. In his dreams, he will imagine them chopping this tree down, and that will make his days uncomfortable. I've already arranged for his nights." It grieved me, though not sharply, to see him take such a malicious satisfaction in his plans for this foreigner. "Does he believe what you told him, Satan?" "He thought he didn't, but our vanishing helped. Let him think as he may, reason as he may, but one thing is for certain, he will water the tree." I reflected a bit and then said, "Satan, you have given him a hard life, I think. Comparatively, it must not be mistaken for a holiday." We flitted from place to place around the world as we had done before, Satan showing me 100 wonders, most of them reflecting in some way the weakness and triviality of our race. Not out of malice, I'm sure of that. It only seemed to amuse and interest him, just as a naturalist might be amused and interested by a collection of ants.
Myself, I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year, stole many.
For as much as a year, Satan continued these visits, but at last he came less often, and then for a long time he didn't come at all. I felt he was losing interest in our tiny world and might at any time abandon these visits entirely. When one day he finally came to me, I was overjoyed, but only for a minute. He had come to say goodbye, he told me, and for the last time. He had invitations and undertakings in other corners of the universe, he said, that would keep him busy for a longer period than I could wait for his return. "And you're going away and will not come back anymore?" "Yes," he said. "We have been comrades a while, and it's been pleasant for us both. But I must go now, and we shall not see each other again." "In this life, Satan, but in another? We shall meet in another, surely." Then all tranquilly and soberly, he made the strange answer, "There is no other." A subtle influence blew upon my spirit from his, bringing with it a vague, dim feeling that the incredible words might be true, even must be true. "Have you never suspected this, Theodore?" "No, how could I?" "It's true. A gust of thankfulness rose in my heart, but a doubt checked it before it could issue in words. And I said, but we've seen that future life, seen it in actuality, and he stopped me. "It was a vision. It had no existence. Life itself is a vision, a dream." It was electrical. I'd had that very thought 1,000 times in my musings. "Nothing exists," he went on. "All is a dream. God, man, the world, the sun, the moon, the wilderness of stars, a dream. They have no existence. Nothing exists save empty space and you."
"I?"
"And you are not you. You have no body, no blood, no bones. You're but a thought. I myself have no existence. I am but a dream, your dream, creature of your imagination. In a moment, you'll have realized this. Then you'll banish me from your visions, and I shall dissolve into the nothingness of which you made me. I'm perishing already. I'm falling. I'm passing away. In a little while, you'll be alone in shoreless space, to wander its limitless solitudes without friend or comrade forever. And you'll remain a thought, the only existent thought, and by your nature inextinguishable, indestructible. But I, your poor servant, have revealed you to yourself and set you free. Dream other dreams, and better ones." "Strange you shouldn't have expected this years ago, centuries ago, ages ago, for you have existed through all the eternities. Strange indeed that you shouldn't have suspected that your universe and its contents were only visions, fictions. Strange, because they are so frankly and hysterically insane, like all dreams."
A God
who could make good children as easily as bad, yet preferred to make bad ones? Who could have made every one of them happy, yet never made a single happy one? Who made them prize their bitter life, yet stingingly cut it short? Who gave his angels painless lives, yet cursed his other children with biting miseries and maladies of mind and body? A God who mouths justice and invented hell, mouths mercy and invented hell, mouths golden rules and forgiveness multiplied 70 times 7 and invented hell, who mouths morals to other people and has none himself, who frowns upon crime yet commits them all. A God who created man without invitation, then tries to shuffle the responsibility for man's acts upon man instead of honorably placing it where it belongs, upon himself, and finally, with altogether divine obtuseness, invites this poor, abused slave to worship him. You perceive now that these things are all impossible, except in a dream. You perceive that they are pure and puerile insanities, the silly creations of an imagination that is not conscious of its freaks. In a word, that they are dream, and you, the maker of it. The dream marks are all there. You should have recognized them. It is true, that which I've revealed to you. There is no God, no universe, no human race, no earthly life, no heaven, no hell. It's a dream, a grotesque and foolish dream. Nothing exists but you, and you're but a thought, a vagrant thought, a useless thought, a homeless thought, wandering, forlorn, among the empty eternities. He vanished and left me appalled, for I knew and realized that all he said was true. This rather solipsistic philosophical literary device brings us to the conclusion of Mark Twain's The Mysterious Stranger, published in 1916, 6 years after Twain's death. This is technically an unfinished work, a sort of compilation of the three different manuscripts that Twain worked on between 1890 and 1910, one of which was a short story, Schoolhouse Hill, set in America, involving Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer's romps with a young Satan. There's a lot of controversy around this publication that boils down to the question of what would Twain have printed, which is an open-ended question, unless you buy into some sort of afterlife, where you may have the opportunity to ask him for yourself sooner than you would probably care to. This tale, from the more involved manuscripts, was set in Aseldorf, Austria. Aseldorf translates into Ass Town, by the way. And all manuscripts ended with the same spooky paragraph. It's up to the reader whether or not Twain is actually promoting solipsism, which would certainly contradict his long humanistic literary tradition and subliminal atheistic suggestions. And you have to take into consideration that in the context of this tale, this explanation for the nature of reality is being given to us by Satan, the trickster. And the story revealed throughout that despite his portrayal in a somewhat positive light, you could only trust his words at your own great peril. As in all works of imagination, one can always adopt the Skoop-Nisker approach. If you don't like the ending, sit down and write one of your own. A personal observation, I noticed a lot of the episodes in this tale bore remarkable similarities to gospel stories. The magic cat with magical powers of free food like loaves and fishes, and the hanging of the old woman with Satan's twisted, those without sin cast the first stone response. The story was told in first person by a boy named Fisher, and so on. I hope you all enjoyed this radio adaptation. We here at The Inner Side will probably be looking at more of Twain's Letters from the Earth in the near future, or for as long as the topic of moral values and the relationship to wretched religious dogma and fundamentalist superstition remain a political diversion for the hideous talking heads and mindless corporate robots who define the parameter of pop media politics and sleight-of-hand propaganda.
Thanks to Scooter and the Christmas Coup Comedy Players for their contributions to the program this week. You can contact us via our website, unwelcomeguests.org, and all shows are archived there in MP3. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone. But that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle will always be filled by